Good grief. Sitting down to actually try to put what I want to explore this morning into words has been a real challenge for me. I found myself backing away from it several times. And that's a bit unusual for me because I love exploring what I believe. I'm incredibly excited to be part of a community that defines itself that way. And in fact, I can honestly say that I think I am quite possibly one of the most fortunate pastors on the planet. When I tell other folks in the church world about this environment, the reactions tend to be either fear, because from some vantage points, this kind of exploration, you know, smacks of heresy and judgment is coming, so make space so you don't get caught up in it. Or this kind of wistful, wouldn't that be nice, or just disbelief. Like, you know, we had some guests here one time when someone else was speaking and made a comment about the way their theology had adjusted around something, and I was talking with them later, and this guy's also a pastor in another community. He was like, I could never say that. Like, I wouldn't have a job on Monday if I said that. And to be in an environment like this is really incredible. Now, this place isn't magical. We have all sorts of challenges and issues. That tends to happen whenever humans get together, whether the setting is religious or otherwise. But it's pretty special and a bit unusual in a really lovely way, and I am deeply grateful. So, when I find myself backing away from exploring something, it makes me recognize that I need to stop and ask myself, why am I backing away? And so what I've decided to do is to be very, very blunt about this. Now, I value kindness, and circumspection is often part of kindness. But on this one, I'm going to do my best to retain kindness while avoiding circumspection. So we'll see how that goes. What I want to explore today might lob a pretty big explosive into a deeply cherished and deeply rooted religious set of ideas, and that scares me a bit. And it scares me for a few different reasons. First of all, it scares me because I'm not sure that I'm up to the task. There are a lot of people in this community that I care deeply about. There are people here that I love. I am not inclined to cause hurt. I'm not a particularly aggressive person by temperament. And I feel very strongly about avoiding anything that even smacks of wielding religious position as power. Now, I realize that that's unlikely to happen in this setting because religious position doesn't equal power structurally here. But in our history, many of us, in our history, it does. And I want to stay very, very far away from that. And it feels like if I don't do a pretty outstanding job of opening this topic up, it really could cause some hurt. The second reason that I find myself backing away from it, and this might sound like it's in contradiction to the first fear, is it scares me because this line of inquiry has been one of the most liberating ones that I have ever encountered in my entire life. How is that scary? Well, in my case, the experience of that liberation has been that it's come as part of a journey that's been through a fair bit of struggle and even sometimes through something that I would use a word like despair for. Walking with people that are struggling is no small part of what I get to do day by day, and it's an honor to get to do that. Causing people to struggle is another matter entirely. Even when my own experience tells me that that struggle may well lead to something better. Which brings me to the third reason that this scares me, and that is that I have no real way of knowing who will find this life-giving and who will find it otherwise. Now, that is always true. But sometimes my sense that I'm closer to the mean or the average point of the journeys in the community is strong, and sometimes I really can't tell, and this is one of those times. So the best I can think of to do is to remind all of us of the nature of the exploration here at the table, that this is an exploration that is not intended to provide a new right answer. In my imagination, the ideal community of faith is one where it's not only possible but normal to not believe what the person beside you believes, and to have that not just be okay, but intriguing and enriching and enlivening. To have that be good. To have the common ground of the community be the exploration itself. All right, so what's the big deal? That's a lot of setup, isn't it? If I ever go the short way, it probably means I'm sick or I have an appointment or I got to get out of here for some reason, right? This can't possibly be normal. To put it as simply as I can, what I want to explore today is the thought that at the center of what we often call Christianity is an event that shatters the idea that everything happens for a reason. And that feels like a big deal to me because that idea that everything happens for a reason is a deeply held one. It's often a comforting one. It's typically a stabilizing one for lots of people. Now, that idea that there's a reason behind the things that happen, that's got a long human history. It's not exclusively a religious history, and it's pretty easy to see. Now, it's also, as an idea, under duress, to the consternation of millions of people. I want to take a quick but sort of broad, albeit Western, look at this because the frame is important for this. The background is important. I grew up on the edge of a generation called the Boomers. As a demographic, we still pretty much operated as though progress was inevitable and as though whatever problems humans encountered could be solved, often through the burgeoning power of science and the wealth that in the Western world was coming with that. We were, as a generation, moving toward, if not utopia, then at least a better and better life. Skip over some demographics to the millennials and to lots of us in this room, whether or not we fit that demographic, and the Boomer Project is pretty much looking like an abject failure. Yes, it is. Yeah? No? Well, I'm going to carry on in that line, and I'm glad that not everyone agrees with me, as I said earlier. Here's what I mean by that. The planet is groaning from our excesses, from our inclination to consume and dispose and to take what we want at the expense of others and to focus on taking care of ourselves first, maybe last. And by the way, in that same period of history, science has refined the power to blow the whole place to smithereens, and some people increasingly seem inclined that way, so that can make it hard to sleep at night. All of this, from the relative vantage point of white power and privilege, which stands in the general stream of European history, which stands on the shoulders of the Greco-Roman empires, and that's important for lots of reasons, and some of them are religious, because it was in the context of those empires that Christianity climbed into bed with the power of the state. Now, we've explored this together before, this very important historic maneuver that Constantine helmed of standardizing Christian doctrine and then using the combination of church and state to both enforce that standard and, because he had the power of the state, to make it illegal at best and fatal at worst to believe otherwise than the stated doctrine of the church. I'm not going to explore that today, but the relationship between that way of operating a religion and, for instance, closer to home, the way the First Nations people of our own country were treated by the Christian church is built on the same blueprint. That's the same set of ideas. You could colloquially say they come out something like, keep the religious rules about what is right, including the cultural ones, and there will be progress toward a better life because God will bless you. It's amazing how fast that idea set can morph into an absolutely vicious tool set. So it's not very hard to see how the streams of general cultural history and more specifically religious history are intertwined, and it's easy to see from that vantage point how Christian belief or theology and power got cozy. What can be harder to see is what might be necessary for Christianity to climb back out of that cozy bed. Which brings us to the idea that everything happens for a reason. In lots of versions of Christianity, this idea that everything happens for a reason leans heavily on one particular text, and that text is Romans 8:28, which in many translations, in this particular case, the NIV says this, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." Now, that's a verse that is easy to cherish. That is a comforting piece of text for some people. Even within the text, only for some people. It can be readily understood as saying, in effect, all things happen for a reason, and especially if they happen to people that love God, who have been, as the text says, called according to his purpose, because those people, the text suggests, have God on their side. I don't know about you, but somewhere along the line, I got the idea that those people, the ones to whom everything happens for a reason, are basically the folks that believe what a particular brand of Christianity says is true about God, who are in something mysterious called a right relationship with God, who are essentially an elite for whom the world operates differently than it does for everyone else, or something along those lines. I had someone recently try to explain to me fairly significant suffering that their family was going through because of a decision that they had to make under time pressure, as that the time pressure was something that God had manipulated so they would make this choice. I stayed in the conversation because their belief was authentic. I just couldn't share it. I just couldn't get there. I barely stayed in my chair. I know that's perspectival. I know that was my experience. It clearly wasn't theirs. The perspective I'm about to offer on that text is not meant to take the wind out of anyone's sails. Like I said, it's a lovely text and it's easy to cherish. I do, however, feel compelled to point out that if we are inclined to make a system of belief about why things happen on the basis of the writing of the Apostle Paul, we might want to take more than one verse into account. And in fact, before we get on to that, we may wish to take into account the historical fact that the version of the text that I mentioned is not the only one we find in the ancient writings of Paul. So we could even stop on that one text, because based on the ancient texts we have, from which we get our English translations, Romans 8:28 could just as readily and defensibly be translated as, "In all things, God works together with those who love him to bring about what is good." And that's a different story already, because now it's collaborative. If you read a well-done, from a scholarly point of view, translation, like the NIV, you'll find a footnote that has that other translation in it. It's strongly supported. The idea that things need to be brought about by the humans in the story rather than God doing all the heavy lifting moves the idea of why things happen into a completely different space. Now, back to taking some more of Paul's thinking into account. In 1 Corinthians, first chapter, so this is in the early going of a letter to this particular community, Paul writes this: "Jews demand signs, and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength." We're just going to scratch the surface of this today, but here's a couple thoughts to just take away and chew on. First of all, it's intriguing to me how Paul sets up the crucifixion as the opposite of a sign or of wisdom. You can think of it this way. Signs and wisdom are two ways that we seek meaning as humans. Wisdom, we could say, is what we're looking for in our systems of debate or of logic, what we might call our apologetics, our reasoned defense of what we believe. That's wisdom. Signs are the unusual or inexplicable events that we might use to justify our beliefs. Those are both easy to recognize as pretty typical parts of religious discourse. They tend to frame most religious disagreements or deliberations. Those are the things we turn to when we're trying to articulate what we believe, what our system of belief is. And Paul gets them both in his sights and says, that's not going to cut it. The Jews demand signs, the Greeks look for wisdom. Christ crucified is neither of those. Well, why not? Well, for one thing, the crucifixion as an event is nonsensical. In the Jewish culture of the day, execution was a form of death that symbolized a divine curse. To die by hanging would have been understood by the ancient Jews as God corroborating justice. To die by hanging was a symbol of someone dying in a way where God made sure that they got what was coming to them. So basically, anyone executed by hanging in the Jewish culture was seen as cursed by God. So this was a kind of death that, as the Christian story unfolds that, this was also the death of an innocent person, let alone a divine one. And for such a person to be murdered in such a horrific way just flies in the face of any ideas about justice or reason or goodness. So from either of those vantage points of signs or wisdom, this just doesn't work. So the event itself can be seen as meaningless and absurd and offensive to such a degree that to try to make it into a sign or wisdom or a system of meaning is not just ridiculous, but it's actually an offense. Basically, it's like Paul is saying in that 1 Corinthians text, this event shatters all of our understandings of what we might think religion and God are about. It blows up our fondest ideas of how God might interact with us, and it breaks apart our sense of reality. In Jewish thought, and we have to remember that this is a Jewish story. It's not a Christian story. It's a Jewish story. In Jewish thought, there's this idea of Shoah. And Shoah operates a bit like this. Shoah is that horrific, unspeakable event that ruptures and renders offensive any attempt to make it into a divine sign or even to use it as an element for a wider rational argument. And that's why the term Shoah is often preferred in Jewish culture over the term Holocaust. So the word Holocaust actually comes from a Greek word that has connections with the notion of religious sacrifice, and consequently, Holocaust is a word that can be understood to have religious significance. In contrast, Shoah simply means destruction, and it has no overtones of anything being justified. If I were to try to provide a cosmic meaning for Shoah, that attempt wouldn't be just misplaced. It would be a profound offense. It's the sort of thing about which we in our human experience might say, colloquially, there's just no making sense of that. So Paul can be understood as essentially arguing that the crucifixion is not about justifying a religious ideology at all. And he does it, in terms of language, by using the word faith, rather than the word belief or sight. That's how he treats it in the text. So this is interesting. For many of us, the idea of faith is in lockstep with the idea of belief or sight, both components of religious structures. Paul separates them. This is an idea that I'm basically just going to set up a bit today. We'll explore it more another time, but here's the short version. Most of us would be familiar with the word faith being used to express the belief that there is some underlying force working for the greater good, intervening to make sure that everything will work out well in the end, regardless of how it looks on the surface or at this moment in time. Like the religious idea of hope that we talked about last week, this idea of faith really doesn't require our involvement, because whatever happens, happens for a reason, and that reason is good. So even if something really, truly horrific happens to a believer, the argument goes that this is part of the cost of a greater good, or perhaps it's even tied to the good of our having moral freedom. That idea of moral freedom and its cost has had some traction for me historically. The harder I look at it, the less well it holds together. More on that another time. This could all sound like an argument against faith, rather than one that takes a shot at things like signs and wisdom. I get that, but as I said earlier, what I want to do today is just open an idea. So what I'm going to do is just leave us with a question to ponder. No happy resolution. In many ways, the question is a rhetorical one. Of course, we will talk about it more another time. But for now, let this rumble around in your head and in your heart and in your life observations this week. What if there was a different way of understanding faith that operated outside of the realm of meaning making? What if there was a way of understanding faith that operated outside of the realm of meaning making? We'll talk about this more. We need to make systems of meaning. What I've said so far could sound like the event at the center of the Christian story blows up making meaning. Not the point, but it needs to be elaborated more. It's a little bit complex because we're so used to it. Unpacking it takes a bunch of work because we're just so accustomed to having those things locked together. We will make systems of meaning as humans. We can't help ourselves. We need them. The perspective from which we make them, how we think of what we have made, alters the way it works in our lives and in the world. To make a system of meaning from the vantage point of the event at the center of the Christian narrative, as though that event provided the kind of structural belief that means that everything happens for a reason, that's what Paul has got his sights set on and is saying, that's not going to work. So is there another way to understand faith such that it operates outside of the realm of insistent meaning-making? What if there was a way of having faith that, despite it not being affiliated with certainty, still carried with it a type of confidence such that it could move us to action in the world rather than primarily producing a kind of pining for another world other than the one we're in? What if there was a way of having faith that, despite it not being affiliated with certainty, still carried with it a type of confidence such that it could move us to action in the world rather than primarily producing a kind of pining for another world? Like that.
Can you say that again?
You're typing this out.
Well, I was texting, but...
Busted. Now you're writing it down, right? Do you want this on the podcast?
No, well, I don't care.
I won't say your name.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, person that was texting while I was trying my best to be, you know. This community is so good for me. I have to stay as a gift. You're just a gift. What if there was a way of having faith that, despite it not being affiliated with certainty, still carried with it a type of confidence such that it could move us to action in the world rather than primarily producing a kind of pining for another world?